headlines, Beijing accuses Washington of paranoid delusion after the U.S. Senate passed a bill aimed at countering what it calls a surging economic threat from China. U.S. Secretary of State says he expects hundreds of anti-Tehran sanctions to remain in place even after the revival of the Iran nuclear deal. And the mayor of the Canadian city of London, where four members of a Muslim family were killed, condemns the bloodshed as an act of hatred and Islamophobia. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, China has strongly condemned the U.S. for approving a bill aimed at countering what Washington sees as Chinese technology threat. In a statement, China's parliament accused the U.S. of, quote, paranoid delusion. It said the bill smeared China's domestic and foreign policies and interfered in its internal affairs. On Tuesday, the U.S. Senate approved a sweeping industrial policy bill to boost the country's ability to compete with Chinese technology. The bill would authorize about $190 billion for provisions to strengthen U.S. technology and research. The bill must now pass the House of Representatives to be sent to the White House for President Joe Biden to sign it into law. Senior fellow at the Pangol Institution, Kindo Zhu, joins us now from Beijing. Mr. Zhu, welcome to the program. Give us your thoughts on the recent developments between Beijing and Washington, and in your opinion, where is this tumultuous relationship headed?
Well, this is the latest move of the United States in their strategic competition, or whatever you call it, their China policy that is, very hostile to China. They are taking, some of the steps are justified, unnecessary probably from the U.S. point of view, to compete with China. For example, more investment, industrial policy. Actually, it is copying a page from China's economic development. Like one of its senators said, our private sector cannot afford such investment, which will bring profits 5 years later. So that's exactly the Chinese five-year plans or long-term plans. Secondly, you can see what is the problem with the bill is like, basically you can call it like an anti-China bill. First of all, it terms China's development as a threat to the United States. I'm not sure that's appropriate for any country to call another country's development is a threat. The Chinese people, just like the Iranian people, just like American people, they have a right to better living standard, to development, and to high technology, the command of high technology. So the U.S. does not have this monopoly. The U.S. Somehow thinks that they are the only country which is suitable to lead the world, which is suitable to lead the world in terms of technology, in terms of innovation. I think there's a lot of hubris to think that way. And I think the Chinese people are entitled to have a better life, are entitled to enjoy this innovation and to do a lot of investment to develop their technology and science. The U.S. basically is using China as an excuse to achieve like unity, because this country is severely divided. They are launching cultural war. Basically, Republicans and Democrats are cutting throat at each other in terms of their competition, let's say, domestic problem. So they are trying desperately to find a way out, by basically attacking China. Somehow attacking China is becoming the common ground of the Republicans and the Democrats. Very unfortunate, because such a bill, and if you play up so much about anti-China mentality or tone, it will produce an adverse effect, obviously. For example, inside China, there will be probably more violence and more racism against Asian Americans. And also, probably, it will produce a big divide between China and the U.S. or in the world, which is something we need the least, because we need cooperation to fight the pandemic. We need cooperation to fight climate change and many, many other challenges.
All right, thanks a lot, Mr. Zhu. Kendo Zhu, senior fellow at Pangol Institution, joining us from Beijing.
Thank you.
Now, sir, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says hundreds of sanctions against Iran could remain in place even if the 2015 nuclear deal is revived.
I would anticipate that even in the event of a return to compliance with the JCPOA, hundreds of sanctions would remain in place, including sanctions imposed by the Trump administration. If they are not inconsistent with the JCPOA, they will remain unless and until Iran's behavior changes. Our responsibility would be to lift sanctions.
Blinken was addressing a Senate committee meeting on the recent talks in Vienna on the revival of the Iran nuclear deal. He said, at this stage, the U.S. does not know whether Iran is willing to do what's needed to come back into compliance. The United States withdrew from the International Court in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. In response, Iran began rolling back its nuclear commitments. Tehran and the remaining parties are now engaged in talks in Vienna to revive the agreement. Tehran has time and again said it will return to compliance only after the U.S. removes all sanctions verifiably. Political commentator Tim Anderson says the U.S. approach toward the nuclear deal revival effort shows its lack of determination to return to the accord.
I think Mr. Blinken has clarified two things. One is that the JCPOA discussions are not really to do with Iran's nuclear industry. It's all about trying to sideline Iran's influence in the region. Iran, having the high moral ground, doesn't really need to do anything. It says it's waiting on the U.S. to come back to compliance in a practical sense. And on the other hand, the U.S. perhaps is trying to provoke Iran to move away from it and therefore gain some kudos, perhaps with the Europeans, but really it seems to be going nowhere.
Iran's foreign minister says his country is ready to facilitate peace talks in Yemen and Afghanistan to promote regional peace and stability. Mohammad Javad Zarif says that he has made the comment during separate meetings in Tehran with UN special envoys to Yemen and Afghanistan. The top Iranian diplomat described as fruitful his talks with Martin Griffiths on Yemen and Jean Arnois on Afghanistan. Zarif told them that peace processes must be owned by all Yemenis and Afghans without what he called external imposition. The UN is trying to bring warring sides in Yemen to the negotiating table to end a Saudi-led conflict which started in 2015. In Afghanistan, the government is in talks with the Taliban group to hammer out a peace deal after years of bloody violence. A Shia Bahraini political prisoner has died from COVID-19 after he was denied medical care. Hossein Barakat was in a coma due to severe lung infection and lack of oxygen. His health conditions deteriorated as the Bahraini Interior Ministry and prison officials refused to release him temporarily. Bahraini officials kept the family of Barakat unaware of his health condition. Some 220 political prisoners in Bahraini jails have been infected by COVID since the pandemic began. Activists say those inmates face medical negligence that is seen as part of widespread discrimination against the country's Shia majority by the ruling Ala Khalifa regime. Well, mourners have held a vigil in Canada to remember four members of a Muslim family killed in a hate-motivated attack on Sunday. The event was held in the capital, Ottawa, in East Central Ontario province. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was in attendance as well. He expressed sorrow over the tragic incident and said, "The thoughts and prayers of all Canadians are with the victims." Trudeau said his government would take action but gave no details. Other mourners attending the event expressed grief and described the attack as a horrific crime.
I want every single one of us, from the highest level of government, from our elected officials, to the everyday commoner that exists in our country, in our province, in our city, in our community, to make a commitment, a solemn promise, that you will do everything within your capacity to fight the scourge of racism, of discrimination, of xenophobia, in any form that it exists. Every single one of us, we need to do our part. And we need to do this
The mayor together. Of London and Ontario province, where the crime happened, issued a statement on Twitter. Ed Holder called the crime an act of mass murder rooted in unspeakable hatred. He said this act of Islamophobia must be followed by acts of compassion. On Sunday, four members of a Muslim family were killed in the Canadian city when a man rammed them with his pickup truck. Police say they were targeted because of their religion. On this edition of the program, Britain and the European Union are set to hold key talks on how to implement their agreement on the country's divorce from the bloc. The meeting in London will cover trading arrangements with a focus on Northern Ireland. Among other issues, Britain is demanding flexibility from Brussels over the province. It says that it wants the bloc to engage with proposals to overcome challenges. The EU is angry at the UK over what it sees as unilateral actions overriding the so-called protocol of the withdrawal deal covering Northern Ireland. Britain officially left the EU in January 2020. The two sides have been trading on new terms since then, but Northern Ireland remains an unresolved issue in post-Brexit relations. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, who's joining us from Brussels. Also, we have Ahmed Caballo, who's with us from the British capital, London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Jerome, one would have thought, you know, to ourselves, we were thinking that by June 2021, EU and Britain would have figured this whole Brexit deal out. It seems that that's still not the case. What are some of the impediments that the two sides are facing right now?
That's right, Bardi. Well, the reason it's sort of coming now again to another crunch time, and they always seem to leave these deadlines, you know, just the negotiations right up to the deadline, is because the crux of the protocol agreement, the key elements were not implemented. There was a sort of a six-month grace period, and that grace period runs out at the end of this month. So now they have to find agreement. But I have to say, speaking to senior officials here in Brussels, there is such a lack of trust towards Boris Johnson and his government. They really do not trust them as negotiating partners. And it's the same for the unionists in Northern Ireland. Half the population are unionists. They're pro-British, but they really do not trust Boris Johnson. You remember Theresa May had a big deal here, and they were going to sign off on it in Brussels. And then the unionist says not a chance, because the deal differentiates Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK, and they consider themselves British. And the deal collapsed because at the time Theresa May's government was being propped up in the House of Commons by a number of DUP, you know, unionist politicians. Then Boris Johnson took over from Theresa May, called a general election. He got a big majority in the House of Commons, so he can effectively do what he likes. And then he put into place this protocol deal, which the unionists absolutely hate. And, you know, they say, actually, it's kind of flowery language to say that there's a border on the Irish Sea to prevent a hard border on the island of Ireland to try and preserve the Belfast Peace Agreement, because effectively that border is a hard border running along the east coast of Northern Ireland. So it's effectively a border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK, because when we have, you know, meat products, dairy products coming in from the rest of the UK into Northern Ireland, they're going to be checked on the border. And for this, the unionists, it's just not good enough. They say that we're part of UK, we're British, and so on. And we're actually coming up to the marching season now in Northern Ireland. And this is where the unionists parade across Northern Ireland to sort of demonstrate how British they are. And really, there's a lot of concern that if a serious deal cannot be reached, then we could have serious violence. I mean, there's always violence. It has decreased over the years during the marching season, but there is concern now that we could have renewed violence, intensified violence in Northern Ireland. And I think Boris Johnson is thinking that, you know, because the EU will want to save face and want to prevent violence, that it will back down and it will become more flexible in terms of the negotiations. But there's another element to it, and that is that Joe Biden has made it clear that he's very much behind the EU on this issue and very much behind the Belfast Agreement, the Good Friday Agreement. And so that actually might apply pressure on Boris Johnson's government, because Boris Johnson's government wants a trade deal with the United States. So it's very much up in the air, and we just have to wait and see how it pans out. But if they don't get an agreement when we have this marching season coming up, we really could see problems.
Ahmed, in London, I'd like to get your perspective on the issue as well. As Jerome mentioned, there's a lot of distrust right now towards the government of Boris Johnson.
Yes, I mean, there was signs that this was going to be a problem from the get-go, but Boris Johnson was so determined to quote-unquote get Brexit done that he implemented the Northern Ireland Protocol, knowing that it was going to upset the unionists, knowing that it was going to have a potential for violence. So he tried to implement it, and he tried to implement it strictly on goods, so there are no checks on people and surfaces, thinking that that would kind of soften the blow. But it hasn't softened the blow. There's been tensions in Belfast, tensions in Derry, tensions throughout what they call Northern Ireland. And those tensions will escalate because, like my colleague said, the people of the unionists in Northern Ireland do not want to see a distinction between themselves and the people of Britain. And they see that their rights, their concerns have been put on the kind of back burner to the concerns of the Irish nationalists who do not want to see a hard border between the north of Ireland and the south of Ireland. And that is what's causing the kind of violence on the streets. And my colleague is right that we haven't really seen anything yet. The violence that's happened so far hasn't even happened in the summer months. When we start to see the so-called orange marches and the marches that happen through Catholic areas of the north of Ireland by unionists, that's when we're going to see this kind of tinderbox really explode.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Dahmid Kalalo joining us from London. Also thanks to Jerome Hughes speaking to us from Brussels. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Bye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Inside Israel. Ashkenazi Israelis include white European settlers both on the left and the right side of politics. This elite group of people have been at a struggle with the other marginalized communities in Israel, including the Mizrahi Eastern and Sephardi Spanish and North African Jews, for decades. Nothing highlights this struggle better than the fight over a small neighborhood in northern Israel named the Nir David Kibbutz. The residents of the neighborhood are upper-class Ashkenazi Israelis. This, while all the other neighborhoods around them are lower-class residents. Now, during the hot summer days, residents from the surrounding areas would like to enjoy the local Asi River to cool off. However, the residents of Nir David Kibbutz won't allow them to do so unless they paint. This goes contrary to Israeli law, which says that rivers in Israel are allowed to be used by all Israelis. Even after the locals took Nir David residents to court and won, they still do not have access to the water. In recent years, a group of non-Ashkenazi residents from communities around the Nir David Kibbutz have been waging a struggle to ensure free public access to the Asi River. They filed a lawsuit against the kibbutz in 2015 that resulted in the Nir David Kibbutz vowing to open access to sections of the river, a promise they never kept. The struggle to free the Asi River has intensified. Israelis are tired of the same status quo. The Nir David Kibbutz and the Asi River highlights the current social disparities and the overwhelming control and perceived favoritism by courts and the Israeli system towards Ashkenazi Israelis. Over the past few months, residents of the surrounding towns, together with activists from across Israel, have been showing up at the Nir David Kibbutz gates every day in an attempt to access the river. They are mostly upset over the Nir David Kibbutz's continued refusal to adhere to the Water Act and allow them to bathe or swim or enjoy summer times on the river during the several heat waves Israel had this summer. In response, they have been met with locked and guarded gates, as well as violence from kibbutz members who attack them with belts and sticks. Earlier in September, the protesters successfully entered the kibbutz and were able to reach and enjoy the river. The day nevertheless ended with violence, as kibbutz members trapped one of the protesters inside the kibbutz gates, kicking him while he lay on the ground, an attack which sent him to the hospital with a concussion and a bruised kidney. Other protesters found their tires slashed.
Actually, the residents of Nir David doesn't allow anybody to enter the kibbutz, even if you offer payment. The only way that you can enter the kibbutz is if you are a member of the kibbutz, or if you have a friend from the kibbutz that let you in, or you are within an organized group that takes part of the touristic enterprise, or you are willing to pay $350 for a tzimmer or a suite inside the kibbutz. Only that way you can enter. So the main, if you ask me, the main reason for them to refuse entrance of outsiders is they want to preserve the privilege of swimming and enjoying the Asi River for themselves without the entrance of other people to that area. Well, I think that it will be more accurate to describe this struggle as not as a struggle between the next town to the kibbutz. It's a national struggle. A struggle of personal people or small communities that are taking control over nature resources, claiming themselves to their own, and gaining from the usage of those natural resources against the law. I guess the struggle between the different parties is being symbolized by some people in the public as an ethnical struggle between the white Ashkenazi Jews to the Eastern, Middle Eastern, North African Jews. I think there are deeper reasons for that. I think that the struggle is between those with privileges in Israel and not necessarily involve their skin color to those that have no resources and have not been privileged from before.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. Free Palestine says the parks are planted on the ruins of Palestinian villages. Boycott these parks, boycott terrorist Israel. Mondo Weiss says Al-Sakhina's lands are now part of the nearby Nir David settlement. No physical evidence remains by which the site may be identified, as the entire area has been plowed and turned into agricultural fields. According to Haaretz says, an issue, at least on the face of it, is whether Kibbutz Nir David has the right to prevent those Israelis who do not live on its grounds from swimming in what is arguably Israel's most beautiful waterway. Joshua says, after years of fighting, Kibbutz Nir David will allow the public to visit the river that runs through it, considered the nicest river in Israel, though they can kiss that goodbye once the masses descend on its aquamarine shores.
Well, they feel superior because the rest of the Israelis came from countries that they were more poor and they were not so well educated. The Jews in Europe, they went to schools and universities, and the other the Arab Jews, Sephardic and Mizrahi, they were more people that they didn't know anything about culture studies, and so they the Zionist state put them together in this state, and of course the Ashkenazic they feel superior, and also because you know that many whites are supremacists, so they feel like a supremacist race against the other Jews, the other target.
This sample of the overall population correctly reflects on the overall privilege received by the white European settlers as opposed to the inequalities, disparities, and racism received by Eastern, Spanish, and North African Jews. The left-wing Ashkenazis enjoy wide support from secularly white Europeans, while the right-wing receives support from non-secularist white European Ashkenazis. Both the left and right receive some support from the rest of Israelis, including Mizrahi, Sephardic, North African Jews, and Arabs, who to them are political game and are in demand during voting times, as they represent a large number, and large numbers means more votes. Israeli observers say that this battle proves that the left-wing Zionists in Israel are actually right-wing with a different color. As the subject is a hot topic in Israel, politicians also took part in the discussion. Members of the left-wing Ashkenazi Israelis claim that the river is part of the kibbutz members' home and that entering it amounts to a violent invasion. Yeli Yakubs, a senior Nir David official and board member of the Israeli Women's Network, the Israel's largest leftist national feminist organization, drew a parallel between the protest and sexual assault. One prominent left-wing personality suggested that the Osun River struggle is just not that important, and another jokingly ranked it at number 43 on a list of the 42 critical struggles for the future of Israel. The right-wing, or those loyal to Netanyahu's party who have some support from Mizrahi Jews, argued that allowing free access to the river would destroy it, as public visitors would not keep the river and its banks clean. This is not true at all, as the tourism office of the Nir David kibbutz actually allows visitors from outside the local area to visit, only if they pay. Activists believe that this argument heavily relies on racist stereotypes regarding the hygiene and cleanliness of the surrounding area's Mizrahi residents.
In general, it's true that the immigrants from North Africa or from Eastern or Sephardic countries have been struggling in their early years, and there were there was a problem with sharing or dividing the natural resources or the financial resources between those different communities. Historically speaking, today things are a little bit different, but still there are pockets of racism and pockets of ill justice between those communities.
Conversation lasted a while on Twitter. Eno says, "Soon the river of trash and ash. I totally understood why they did not want to open it. They should at least install a system that ensures those who litter can be identified and held accountable." Joshua points out, guards at Nir David near Beit Shean chasing away hikers who want to visit the Asi stream, a public waterway which flows through the kibbutz, but which they zealously guard, unless you pay them protection by staying at a guest house there. This is an ongoing fight. Sharuna says, the Ashkenazim appointed Arabs to guard them from the Mizrahis. Scum. Oz says, common denominator, a minority that controls the majority, streams and routes in the areas of the kibbutzim, natural resources of us all, an elite that controls the top, academia, and other clubs close to the masses. Salute and be silent.
Well, what's true about religion, again, is that, you know, all the Jews were religious everywhere in the world until, let's say, the 19th century, the later part of the 18th century. And then in the later part of the 18th century into the 19th century, you had in Europe the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment was really a movement away from religion, towards science, towards secularism, and you had in the Jewish community Jews leaving the religious world and becoming secular. Some became communists, like Trotsky. Some became socialists, like Ben-Gurion and many of those that founded the State of Israel. Well, you never had the Enlightenment in the Middle East, which is on today a problem. So the Middle East never had a concept of secular. And so Jews, Mizrahi Jews, weren't as orthodox, they weren't as strict as the Ashkenazi Jews had been when they were religious, you know, and they mix much more what we'd call today secular and religious. They're much lighter in their religion, but they're religious. or we would call them, I guess, traditional might be the best word to call them. They're not super Orthodox, but on the other hand, they're not secular either. And I think this is a whole issue in the Muslim world. The entire Muslim world, I think, is wrestling today with this idea, with this problem of enlightenment and secularism and religion. It's a tension, and so it's also a tension between Ashkenazi Jews and Mizrahi Jews.
Nir David neighborhood has over the past few months highlighted the struggles in what is seen as a small sample representing the greater fight between Ashkenazi Jews and the other marginalized communities. Nir David is predominantly made up of Ashkenazim, Jews of European descent who founded Israel and dominated its resources, as well as its economic, cultural, and military institutions. These neighborhoods house Ashkenazi Jews both in the right and the left. The residents of Nir David do not allow access to the Asi River, and if they do, it will not be free. They have erected fences and barriers to prevent public access to the river. According to the Israeli regime's Water Act, waterways are public property that must remain accessible and open to all. Despite this, the status quo remains the same. In order to change the small sample presented here, the bigger picture needs to come down.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad.
His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: لا تجعلوا علمكم جهلا ويقينكم شكا، إذا علمتم فاعملوا، وإذا تيقنتم فأقدموا.
Imam Ali stated, "Do not turn your knowledge into ignorance or your conviction into doubt. When you gain knowledge, act upon it, and when you acquire conviction, proceed on its basis." Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, the son of Abu Talib. One of the profound things which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is coming from the words of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, who has told the Muslims that Imam Ali alayhi salam truly has a universal persona. We find in the historical texts that on the day of the conquest of Khaybar, the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam addressed Imam Ali alayhi salam publicly and said the following things, and this has been reported by Khawarizmi. The Messenger of Allah said, "There is no open or hidden distance between you and me, O Ali. What is hidden inside my chest and I am informed of, this is also inside your chest. Your children are truly my children. You, O Ali, are the gate of my knowledge, and whoever seeks my knowledge must hear it from your tongue. Your flesh, O Ali, is my flesh, and the blood running in your veins, O Ali, is running in my veins with no difference." Very beautifully and eloquently and concisely but profoundly, the Messenger of Allah has taught all of the Muslims that the role model, the ideal for the Islamic Ummah is Imam Ali alayhi salam. If the Muslim Ummah is to receive and learn lessons from great leaders in Islamic history, then Imam Ali alayhi salam is the foremost leader whom we should follow. And we find that the Holy Prophet Muhammad has practically called Imam Ali himself. He has called Imam Ali as his self. If we want the Muslim Ummah to return to the ways of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, we must all look towards the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
You for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil. Ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, "Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger." For protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet. For protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I'm Atta, the producer of the program To My Brother, and at this moment I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Fayyaz Jafar. I hope you enjoy it.
Manik al-Ashtar is of this unique station in the eyes of the commander of the faithful Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. And according to historians, Manik al-Ashtar's family comes from Yemen. And he is given the title al-Ashtar because in the Battle of Yarmouk under the commandment of Umar ibn al-Khattab, Manik al-Ashtar went out and fought. And in the midst of the battle, he was struck in either his right or his left eye with a sword or with a spear. And that left a mark on the eye of the companion of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen. And when someone has a scar on top of their eye in classical Arabic language, they would say that someone was given the title al-Ashtar. But Malik al-Ashtar's most unique station and relationship with the Imam alayhi salatu wasalam, of course, came during the Battle of Siffin. And to put it into a very unique perspective, and to try to explain exactly the unique station of this particular great companion of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, we have to again understand it in terms of the climate that we're living in. Who was Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen fighting in the Battle of Siffin? He was fighting the army of Muawiyah ibn Abu Sufyan. And per the custom of that time and per the reports of the historians, what would happen was that there would be many different flanks of the army of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen, as there were many different contingencies of the army of Muawiyah. And the battle would be fighting simultaneously one-to-one. So for instance, there was a battle taking place on the right wing, and another battle taking place on the left wing, and another battle taking place in the middle. And Malik al-Ashtar, who was the commander of the army of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen, the flag bearer of the army of Amir al-Mu'mineen, alayhi salam, was piercing through the army one by one of the right wing of the army of Muawiyah until he's almost able to reach the tent of Muawiyah. And in reality, Malik al-Ashtar was just a couple of people away from putting his sword into the tent of Muawiyah ibn Abu Sufyan, when all of a sudden, as we know, the army of Muawiyah, they went, they took the Qurans, put them on top of the spears. The whole story we know, where Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, he would respond, "Ana Quran al-Natiq, I am the speaking, the talking, the walking Quran. Why are you submitting toward the tactics of Muawiyah?" At this moment, Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen sends one of his companions toward getting toward Malik al-Ashtar. Eventually he reaches Malik al-Ashtar and he says, "Oh Malik, Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam says that you have to return back." In reality, he was probably just moments away from going one-to-one with Muawiyah himself. And imagine the pain in the heart. He's about to fight against the man who is the greatest tyrant in human history, yet without any sort of hesitation, in absolute submission toward the words of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salatu wasalam, he puts his sword away and he turns around. That's what makes Malik Malik, a man who at the moment of the word or of the statement of the imam of his time, he's ready to submit to what he has to say.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
You heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.